This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by BlackStarLabs.com, home of the best tasting protein powder out there. You can check them out at BlackStarLabs.com. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 164. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me is Dr. Jonathan Fass. What up, John?
What's up, Kevin?
Still funny the second time around.
Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like such a tool whenever I... whatever.
Is it the headshot that we're using for the live stream?
No, it's the doctor thing.
Oh, I see. Doctor.
Doctor.
That's funny. It's an airplane joke.
No, that was from Spies Like Us.
Oh, that's right. Chevy Chase and...
Yep. Dan Aykroyd.
You know they're making Ghostbusters 3D?
I've heard this. I've heard the rumors.
It's real. All right. So for FitCast News, we're doing it live. Got tons of new videos up on YouTube.com/TheFitCast. Been posting a ton of new stuff up there. Some circuits that I've been doing at Boyle's, rope circuits, battling ropes, new plank variations if you want to check them out. So do that up. The FitCast accountability blog and contest details are up. We're going to wait until the end of next week to announce the people that are selected on episode 165 next week. So if you want to, you can still head over to thefitcast.com. You can check out the page and the details on how to apply for that. And we will announce the people who are going to be up and be doing that with us. Following that is I wrote a quick blog post called Tools of Accountability starring Tim Allen, and the blog post has a bunch of different tips on how to track your progress, how to stay accountable, so on and so forth. Coming up in a little bit, you're going to hear from Jim Wendler of Elite FTS answering a bunch of questions. We did about a one-hour interview, which you can also watch the video of on ustream.com. I'll post a link for that as well if you want to watch the video, but it's just like it is right now. It's me and a headshot, so you really don't need to. and then next up, I want to quickly mention Dave Fink, who is working on a new version of the FitCast logo for us. He has a boxer rescue that I've been... We actually talked about this, obviously, the first time that we recorded last week, but we want to bring it up again just to make sure... that people get to check out his boxer rescue. I think we may have talked about it once a while ago in the past, but it's greenacresboxerrescue.com is the website. And what they actually do there is they take in dogs. They actually rescue dogs from families that cannot keep the dogs anymore due to financial reasons. They have to move. They go to an apartment that doesn't allow for animals, things like that. And the cool thing about it is that actually don't, shelters do a great job, but they keep the dogs in like cages and kennels and stuff like that. So what these guys do is they actually take in the dogs themselves personally. They live in a household with other dogs, you know, more like a normal life, and they're not kept in cages until someone eventually comes and adopts a dog. And we talked about pet rescue in the past, and it's a great service that he's doing and the guys over there are doing. So definitely if you want to donate to a good cause, it's greenacresboxerrescue.com, and I'll post a link for that in the show notes. And he also mentions that 100% of the donations go directly to the dogs, so it's straight up, it goes right into the foundation that they have set up there. And also, on a related note, talking about donations, John, we talked obviously a little bit about this last week when we did it live, but the obviously the horrible tragedy over in Haiti, multiple earthquakes, really, terrible situation over there. And please, if anyone out there who is listening or watching can send a couple dollars to the American Red Cross. I know WhiteHouse.gov has a site set up, and the way I did it is I just went on Amazon.com, and you can literally click a thing on the side, and you can just use your Amazon payment payment method, you know, whatever it is, like your credit card, and just donate money directly through that. And it takes 2 seconds. And, you know, that $20 could bring food for 20 people. So, that, you know, really do whatever you can to get the, you know, get the word out there and donating. And if you have an extra couple bucks, or, you know, you don't need to go to the movies tonight, you can stay in, send that money to the people over in Haiti. They really need it a lot more than we do right now.
Hope for Haiti, now.org. 100% of the proceeds go to Haiti. And I feel like deja vu all over again. But when we talked about this last week, I'd mentioned something that my mother said that I thought was pretty astounding. When we think back to the travesty and the horror of what the World Trade Center was, we lost something about like 3,000 people, and that devastated our country for weeks and months. And living right outside of New York, I mean, it really was something that was very life-changing. Well, Haiti is looking at over 200,000 dead, so that's when you do those kinds of numbers, that's 70 World Trade Center disasters. So just to put that in perspective.
Yeah, it's again, people, please do whatever you can to help support the cause, and we will continue to talk about it, and hopefully those people over there will get the help that they need, and hopefully, you know, the earth, you know, they'll stop having those earthquakes. You just heard of another one that happened this past week, so you know, those guys deserve a lot better. All right, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break. We're going to jump into the mailbag, and we're going to take some questions from the audience as well, if they have them. So stick around. We'll be right back. Hey guys, just a quick editor's note that we're going to run the Jim Wendler interview now, and then after the Jim Wendler interview, we're going to go into the mailbag. So here's Jim. With us right now is Jim Wendler. Jim is a senior editor and sales manager of Elite Fitness Systems. He's worked as a strength and conditioning coach at the University of Kentucky, where he worked with several different teams, including football and baseball. He played football and graduated from the University of Arizona, where he earned 3 letters. Jim's best lifts include a 1,000-pound squat, a 675-pound bench press, a 700-pound deadlift, and a 2,375-pound total in the 275-pound weight class. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge pleasure to finally get you on the show. We've been getting tons and tons of requests to have you on, and it's just, like I said, it's a huge pleasure to finally get you on to talk to you. But we will get right into the questions. We got quite a bit, and obviously a lot of them revolve around your 5-3-1 program. The first thing I just want to ask you, you know, is there anything we kind of missed in the bios, or, you know, anything in your background that you know, the listeners should know, and also just a little bit about the background behind the 5-3-1 program?
As far as the bio, you know, the last time I competed when I did the 20-75 was spring of 2005. Since then, I was about 280 when I did that. I've dropped about 50 pounds or so, and mostly I just didn't want to lift, you know, competitively power lift anymore, and I just wanted to drop some weight. So it took me about a year to kind of get down, and I've kind of revamped my training. I do a ton of lifting, obviously, still, but I've also added a shitload or a poop load of conditioning work too. I just, you know, coming from a football background and being athletic my whole life, I was really sick and tired of being a fat ass. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how the program started, was I wanted to be able to basically get in the weight room, not have to think too much, have a ultimate goal at the end of the year, at the end of 12 months, rather than just kind of going in and you know, just training. And I wanted to also get into shape. So it was kind of like I wanted to had the best of both worlds, and it took me about 3 years to really kind of tweak it here and there, and I tried out on a whole bunch of people and had a lot of screw ups, and you know, it was kind of a tough going, but that's kind of the origins of that program, was the simplicity of it and being able to track progress over a long period of time, as well as maintain and increase my condition levels, and really not have to be fat to get strong, which a lot of people believe to be so. And to be honest, I mean, it does help. I mean, not to be so much fat, but, you know, to gain that weight, it does help. But that's kind of the origin of the program right there. I mean, the people that do have the book, I mean, I kind of go into it a little bit deeper in the introduction. But it's become a, you know, obviously it's become very, very big, bigger than I ever thought it would be. And really the reason why, I think, is because it gives people exactly what to do, and it's easy to follow, and it gives you the results just based on the basic philosophies that I lay out in the book. So I'm just, it's really flattering, and I'm very humbled about the response. And my whole life since I've been probably around 11 or 12 has been revolved around getting stronger. That's all I've ever wanted to do. I begged my dad since I've been a kid to start lifting weights, and he allowed me finally when I was 13 years old. And he looked me in the eye, and he said, you know, once you start this, you better not quit. You know, I will not have a quitter. And my dad was real big on that. And fortunately or unfortunately, I guess the way you look at it, I haven't stopped since I've been 13. So I've been obsessed with this. And since I've been a kid, I've been writing programs since I've been a kid. Since, thankfully, I didn't have the internet back then. You kind of have to force yourself. You know, there's so much shit out there, and it's hard to weed through all of it. And I was able to, you know, I was writing programs for people and running strength programs at a very, very early age. And just, I mean, to be honest, Kevin, I'm not qualified to do much more. I mean, I did very well in school, and I'm very, very happy to be part of this this industry, because I don't know what the hell else I'd be doing. So, I have really a great job, and I have a great avenue to speak, and I feel like I do have something to say, even though some people may not agree with it. So, you know, for everyone that asked you to be on the show and you asking me, it's a great honor, and I'm very, very happy. So, but there you go. That's my little spiel there. So,
well, trust me, the you know, it's pleasure's all mine. It's an honor to get you on. But, you know, one of the things that you brought up is that you've been training since you're 13. And one of the things that you bring up in the manual, when you talk about dips, and you mentioned that you'd never had any shoulder injuries. Have you ever gone through any kind of major injuries, and how have you dealt with them?
I played football since I've been 12 years old, I guess. Seventh grade or whatever. And I've been acting. I threw the discus. I was actually all state in the discus, if you can believe that. And I obviously played. I played football at the Air Force Academy, and then I transferred to Arizona, and I played football there. So I played football basically from 12 to 23, and I've been lifting heavy that entire time. I did have nothing major. I mean, you know, with football, you're always going to have. You know, I have really bad tendonitis in my shoulders, really bad tendonitis in my knees, and sprained ankles, broken ribs, broken fingers. But that's not very major. I mean, that's just playing football. I've never torn a knee. Never, you know, had any surgeries on my shoulders or anything like that. And even when I was powerlifting, I've tore pecs. I've torn both my pecs. I've torn both my lats. But nothing that required surgery. So all in all, I've been pretty lucky. And I think part of with football in general, there's a lot of luck involved. But I took a lot of pride in being in really good shape and being strong. And the guy that I kind of looked up to with that was Roger Craig. The guy was always in phenomenal shape. Walter Payton was the same way. I grew up in the Chicago area. And those guys, you know, took strength and conditioning to a different level. And so I always thought that, you know, there's always a lot of luck involved, but there's also a lot of things that you can do to make yourself, you know, better, mm-hmm. and give yourself a little bit of a chance of not getting injured, So I really prided myself on strengthening the areas, you know, the legs, and I was the shoulder girdle and stuff like that through real basic weight training. So, but I think, you know, with powerlifting and stuff like that, the number one thing I learned, you know, being around Dave for as long as I have, Dave Tate and Louis Simmons and a lot of the guys at Westside Barbell that did deal with injuries, was when I did feel something coming on, I played it safe. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people call that being a pussy, but I'd rather puss out for 4 weeks and train the rest of my life than push through something and tear something, and then you're screwed the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So part of it was, again, luck, and part of it was just being smart. Again, I don't, you know, I'll give you a for example. I was at the Maryland Death Fest this year. It's a big 3-day festival, all these, you know, grind and death metal bands. And, of course, you know, I'm a big fan of having some cocktails. And I, you know, got plowed and stuff, and I went to sleep, and I fell asleep on my shoulder. And of course, my asshole roommates, who are all lifters, you know, I woke up the next morning, and they're like, dude, I can't believe you slept on your shoulder all night. Because I slept on my shoulder. I'm like, well, you know, it wouldn't kill you to roll me over, would it? And that, you know, what a bunch of dicks, right? So that day, I mean, I woke up, I couldn't move my arm. I mean, it was completely done. I had to kind of, even when I was walking, I had to hold it. And I thought it was, you know, it was done. And even when I was get back in the weight room, it still killed me. I couldn't do anything. And so instead of pressing forward and pressing forward, I just simply took the time off with upper body lifts. And I did that for about 4 or 5 weeks or so. And I didn't really do anything. And I mean, I still squatted and still pulled. But that extra time off, that extra 4 or 5 weeks or so to let my body heal itself, worked wonders, because if I would have pushed through it, God knows what would have happened. So, you know, taking off that little bit of time for a lifetime of training, to me is you know, what's 4 weeks, right, in the span of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And as I've gotten older, I'm 34 years old right now, you quickly realize that this passion that I have for strength training, it's finite. You know, it's going to end. I know that. And you can't be 90 years old and still be squatting 800 pounds or whatever. I know you still can train, but I realize that, and I realize I'm in this for the long haul. So I'd rather be smart about it now than, you know, and then and continue as long as I can and just be and enjoy this time that I have. And I think, you know, just from a training perspective and a programming perspective in general, you know, people want everything today and want everything now. And when I hear that, it frustrates me, because when I think of strength training in general and training in general and this whole lifestyle, it's a lifetime commitment. It's just not 8 weeks or 12 weeks. You know, it's 20 years. And if people would take that attitude, they'd be a little more patient with their gains. And so, for example, let's say someone wants to bench press 300 and they're benching 200 right now. And I really want to bench 300 at the end of the year. Well, let's just focus on getting 205 and 210. All right, take your time, because if you take a little bit longer approach, you're going to get there. If you take big strides and big strides and keep on trying for 300, you're never going to get there. Does that make sense to you?
Perfect sense, and it's something that I battled with in the past, and it's all about just, you know, I was going to, you know, ask you, you know, how have you really dealt with teaching patience to your athletes?
Well, when I was at Kentucky, it's a little bit different, because in any big-time school, it's because those kids, a lot of those kids are, you know, going to be there for 3 years. They're going to leave early. But at the same time, even if you do have that patience and start slow, the payoff, even in a short amount of time, let's say 1 or 2 years, is going to be a lot bigger than if you get frustrated and try for too much. And if you do the, we'll take example of my program, is people's big beef as well. You know, I don't want to start at 90% of my max. You know, I always say start too light. That will reap bigger dividends in 5 months or 6 months than if you just try and max out all the time. And you'll just kind of go for broke from day one. If you kind of ease into it, you'd be surprised in 5 months you're going to be a lot farther ahead than you ever thought you would be. But part of it is I don't know if I need to teach patients, because people need to be honest with themselves. To me, this is my life. This is my lifestyle. It's always been part of it. And people need to adopt that for themselves, or accept the fact that maybe they're not cut out for it, or maybe they have another hobby they'd like to do. No one goes into, playing piano and expects to play chopsticks the first, year, and then Beethoven the third and fourth year. It's a long process. And it's the same thing with strength training, with anything in general. It's just that patience. And unfortunately, our society doesn't really preach that anymore. Look at there's a ton, I'm a huge heavy metal fan. There's a ton of great bands out there, but look at Slayer. Those guys have, persisted over 30 years, and they're still as strong as they are, back in the day. So, all they did was stick to their, AC/DC is another way. I'm not a big fan of AC/DC, but, they stuck to their guns. They've done what they know they can do, and they just kept on persisting through it. And, I can relate this to a lot of portions of my life. I mean, even walking on at the University of Arizona, I eventually got a scholarship, but those 3 years I didn't have a scholarship, man, that's tough. You're playing scout team your whole life, for 3 years you feel like you're just getting the shit knocked out of you. But sometimes, the perseverance will really, really make a difference. In fact, it always does. So there you go.
Yeah.
But anyway, with injuries and stuff, man, I'm telling you, if you feel like you're getting injured or something's tweaked, take some time off and be smart about it. It's going to pay off always.
Awesome, great stuff. I have a couple more of my questions. Then we'll jump into the listener stuff. This is actually one from someone that I work with, Jamie, who's actually quite a big fan of yours. And one of the things he's been looking at is kind of using the 5-3-1 template for bringing it in with groups of athletes. And obviously one of the things that a lot of the athletes that we have do are pull-ups, and how would you go about implementing that, or would you even consider implementing it as one of the main lifts in the 5-3-1 program if you're doing a 4-day a week?
You mean using the set and rep template there?
Correct, yeah.
I have not done it. I need to do it because I know a lot of people have done it and have had a lot of success. The key is you've got to factor in your body weight, and people try and take a percentage of your body weight and try and figure all that shit out. And I'm really not that smart, so I actually just use all of my body weight. So let's say, for example, you weigh 200 pounds and you put a 25, you want to test out and see where you are, then you would add that body weight into the equation. So yeah, it can be done. But at the same time, a lot of kids aren't, a lot of athletes and people in general can't do chin-ups worth of shit anyway.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, the best thing that I've found is if you're able to do a few, let's say five or something, would be just to do multiple sets of one or two reps throughout the entire workout. And that means, between every single set that you do, just go grab a chin-up bar in between and, do bust out two reps. So, for example, I've done up to like 30 or 40 sets of three before during a workout. Anything I do a set of chin-ups in between. It's part of my warm-up. I'll do some foam rolling, then hit a set of chins. And then, so anything I can to get that volume up. But as a separate lift, it can be done. The only problem that I always see is you start applying that set rep formula to too many things, and then not everything can be important. And so sometimes something will be diminished. And so what I've done is I do have, the squat, bench, deadlift, the overhead press. I do add power cleans in there. And I would like to do the chin-ups at some point. But I have yet to actually do it. But I know people have done it. I know it can be done, but it has to be done with an athlete that's strong enough to handle some serious weight around their waist when they do it.
Gotcha.
But again, I think, I do have a question that you did ask here, that someone had written in about doing the chin-ups, but that extra volume has worked wonders.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. So there you go. But yeah, have at it, man.
Let's talk a little bit about the prowess. This is going to be the last thing that we'll mention before we get into the listener questions. But with the Prowler.
Just got done pushing the Prowler, too.
Perfect timing. Obviously, you know, fantastic piece of equipment. You know, it seems like any facility that I go at now has a Prowler, and even we've seen some other companies come out with something that looks very similar. And the one thing I have for you is one is that you know what kind of conditioning you know drills do you use for the Prowler? Is it more or less just you know sprints and marches, you know, and pulls, or is there anything else you can you know? I'm sure you guys have thought up some crazy things to use it for. And also, you know, in regards to that, how would that fit into the conditioning for someone doing 5-3-1? You know, is it something that they can do at the end of every workout? Would they do it on their non lifting days? How would they set that up?
Okay, with the Prowler, I mean, when we first got it, there was we farted around with a lot of different shit, and it just got to the point where we said, screw it, we're just going to push this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's just basically sprints or as fast as you can go, walking too, but walking actually is pretty damn hard because it takes it less time. Or it takes you more time, I should say, to push it over a certain distance. So we haven't really, you know, after all this stuff that we were doing, you know, different kinds of pulls and going backwards and all this other crap, it just got to the point where it's like, you know, screw it, this thing is made to be pushed. Yeah, high handles and low handles. You know, and I'll give you a for example is, you know, in my workouts personally, what I do is every day that I work out, I do some sort of hard conditioning afterwards. All right, so today, for example, I squatted today, I did some power cleans, and then I went outside and pushed the Prowler. Yesterday, I benched. On Wednesday, I benched, did my accessory work, and I went outside and pushed the Prowler. Now, a lot of people like to do it on their off days, and if that's all they can do, if that's what their schedule dictates, that's fine. Because it's better than not doing anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I would rather have people do it on their training days because it kind of puts all the stresses on one day. So when you're off, like, for example, tomorrow, I'm on the road and I'm off. And so when I'm off, I'm off. And my body's recovering. So I'd rather put all the stresses on one day. The other problem that I hear a lot of people have is, like, for example, I benched yesterday and I did the Prowler and I came back and squatted today, right? And people are always like, well, shit, isn't your squat going to suffer? Your legs are tired. And yes, it's going to suffer. It's going to suffer for a little bit, but your body will adapt eventually. Okay? And the other thing that I also run a lot of hills, too. And actually, that tires my legs out more than even the Prowler. And it took me about 3 or 4 weeks to get my squat to where it was before because my legs were so exhausted. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of different, you know, ways you can kind of go about it. But the bottom line is you got to kind of nut up, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of this overthinking and people being overzealous and trying to think, you know, I got to do this. It's got to be programmed. Man, I'd say fuck it, dude. Just train.
Mm-hmm.
And if you train hard and you get your mind where it needs to be, you'd be surprised at what you can accomplish. And, you know, if you believe it's really going to affect you and you're going to have a shitty workout, then guess what's going to happen? You know, I just choose not to have a shitty workout. I know that sounds pretty barbaric or simple-minded, however you want to say, but that's kind of my philosophy. Now, on the days that I do squat and deadlift, I generally push the Prowler a little bit harder, maybe a little bit heavier, maybe a little longer. On the upper body days, it's not as intense. Yeah, unless, you know, some guy comes in or a friend of mine wants to challenge me or something, I'll always run those fuckers in the ground, no matter what. It's my pride and joy. I always want to be stronger. And I always want to be, you know, be in better shape than anyone, at least try to be. So, plus, I got that old man endurance. Because we have high school kids that come in, I can outrun and I'll do any of that stuff. And it's not simply that I'm in better shape; it's just mentally I'm stronger than they are because they haven't learned how to tap into that. So, I guess what I'm trying to say is, sometimes people want to overthink this stuff, as far as when to put the condition and stuff like that. Man, just if you follow a basic, this is what I tell people. I really want to write an article about this. It's just called "If in Doubt." And if people are kind of paralyzed by what they're doing, I just tell them like this. It said, warm up and use the Frankl's Agile 8. It's a little sample agility warm-up hip flexibility thing that he's got. You can find it on his website. It's really easy. Just Google the Frankl Agile 8. It'll pop up probably the first two things. Do the 5-3-1 program. Pick a couple assistance exercises. And then after that, go out and push the prowler, go run a hill, go drag a sled, do something like that, and do that every time you train. It can't get any easier than that. And if you put your mind to it and accept that the fact that you will get stronger, then you're going to do it. So it really can't get much easier than that, man.
Awesome. Let's see. Let's jump into a couple of the questions from the listeners. The first one that we have... as I think we're going to hit into the chinos. But it says, I love all your articles on T-Nation and Elite FTS. I'm 21 years old, 5'6", 149 pounds at 13% body fat. I was a fat, weak, book smart kid without an ounce of muscle who never played a single sport with my whole life. I lost a bunch of weight 2 years ago unhealthily. I started lifting weights last year, and all my numbers were pathetically weak. I'm talking squat at 60 pounds, deadlift 80 pounds, bench 45 pounds. Pathetic. So I've stuck with the basics and have worked on getting stronger on these lifts. Here are my stats now: squat 155, deadlift 230, bench 115, press 80. I know they're still really pathetic compared to what quote strong guys lift. But I'm pretty much stuck here. I can add more weight, but to be honest, my form deteriorates, and I know that's bad, so I humble myself and lower the weight. I've had some good days where I progress slowly, but there are these are the numbers. I'm pretty much stuck, been stuck for a couple months. I'm too weak. Am I too weak to try 5-3-1? Do you have any other tips to get me stronger? I really want to get stronger in the press, especially. My shoulders look like tangerines, and I want grapefruits. P.S. Aside from these lifts, I do bodyweight stuff like chin-ups, dips, and rows. If that makes any difference, and he gives us some numbers. So what do you think, Jim?
Okay, first of all, this is pretty damn amazing, just his progress, from when he started. I mean, it really is. I mean, his squat went up from 60 pounds to 155, deadlift went from 80 to 230 and stuff like that. So that's actually pretty damn impressive. And he does. Whoever you are, man, I don't know if you have your name on here, it's actually pretty admirable, and my hat is off to you. The first thing that I look at this is, he did lose a lot of weight, and he admits that he did it very unhealthily. If that's a word, I'm not really sure. So I think right now is, and I don't want to get all weird about this, there's probably some body issue things going on here mentally that he probably needs to deal with. And I'm not a psychologist, but I think that's, being 34 and dating my fair share of women, and seeing how guys are now these days about their weight, you might have to tackle that. And that's just coming from a different perspective, I guess. The second thing, would be he would have to understand that if he does want to get stronger, he's going to have to deal with that issue by trying to gain some weight. And he can do that in a healthy way because, he's 149 pounds. Even gaining 10 or 15 more pounds is going to do a shitload for his strength. Is he too weak to do the 5-3-1? No, because I have a girl right now that just started working for Elite FTS, and she's doing the program, and she's progressed. I think she's probably been there 8 weeks now, and it's been unbelievable. I mean, she went from squatting I don't know, maybe 95 for five or something. Today, I think she did 105 for 12. She deadlifted, like, you know, in the beginning, maybe 185 for two, and then she did 225 for five.
Wow.
Stuff like that. The only thing that I think that he'd probably have a tough time with, obviously, even would be the press. And he talks about turning his tangerines into grapefruits. And here's the little get-up I have for that. Would be when I first started implementing the overhead press in my training, it was when I was, you know, Christ, I was maybe 27 or so. And my shoulders were pathetically weak. So instead of, you know, doing heavier weights and stuff like that, I stuck with a ton of volume. And a ton of volume for me was, you know, I would do five sets between 10 and 15 reps. And I'd had a separate day just for that because it was so bad. And I would recommend to him that he could probably use the other lifts on the 5-1, and then on that separate day for the press, just do a ton of volume. You know, and right now he's pressing, you know, 80 pounds. You take, you know, even if he just took the bar and, you know, maybe a 55 pounds or something, did repeated sets of 10 to 15, it would probably pay dividends in the long run. That would be my advice for him. With the chin-ups, dips, and rows, he's always in the, I'm not sure what he means by rows, and maybe, whatever, we'll just take the chin-ups and dips. He does, you know, about sets of 10 on each one of them. Again, I would recommend that he cut that in half, so 5 reps, okay, and do multiple sets of 5 reps or 3 reps over a longer period of time. So maybe instead of doing, you know, 2 sets at 8, he would do, which is, you know, 16 reps, he might do 8 sets of 4. So now it's 32 total reps. It's just, it's real simple stuff like that that would probably get him going. But honestly, he's definitely strong enough to do that, and he needs to gain some weight. And that's going to be the quickest way to getting stronger. And, all you know, it could be something as simple as drinking 2 more protein drinks a day with whole milk. But again, I think he probably needs to deal with some eating issues too. And I don't mean that in a bad way at all. I don't hope he doesn't get offended. But I think that might, it's definitely going to come into play. So, and he can easily keep the fat off by doing some simple, you know, running, some cardio work, some pushing the prowler, running up hills, doing stuff like that. You know, if he is afraid of getting, you know, a little bit more spare tire around the stomach. So, there you go. That's what I would tell this kid. And I tell you what, man, that's a hell of a job making those lifts, man. So congratulations, whoever you are. So
yeah, that's my fault. That's actually it's from Johnny.
All right, good job, Johnny.
The next question that we have, Jim, I am new to the sport of powerlifting. I'm going to compete in my first meet this February. My squad is not where I would like it to be. I'm pretty certain it's because my technique sucks. I feel most comfortable in a sumo stance in my deadlift, so I switched over to a wide stance in my squat for a few months, about 3 cycles of 5-3-1. My hips would hurt in the bottom position, pinching in hip flexors. Someone recommended that I not use a wide stance raw because it would wreck my hips, so I brought my stance back in narrower to just wider than shoulder width apart. This took care of the hip pain, but I'm not moving as much weight either. What is your recommendation for raw lifters' squat stance? Also, does a wide stance, as seen a lot of powerlifting videos, only apply to geared lifters in squat suits? And would you recommend different shoes, Olympic, Chucks, wrestling shoes based on stance? I know the answer is most likely it depends. So hopefully my squats, my stats can help a little. Height 6 feet, weight 195. I've not done a 1-rep max test for a while. So here are my current lifts: squat 315 for 3, deadlift 405 for 3, bench 235 for 5. Thanks in advance. And I will get the name of that person too.
Okay. All right. Okay, the first question is, what is your recommendation for a raw lift or squat stance? In general, he needs to be a lot, and this coincides with the next question, that the wide stance is seen on a lot of powerlifting videos only applied to gear lifters and squat suits. The answer to that question is yes. When you squat with gear, whether it be a single ply, which is pretty advanced stuff all the way up to, you know, wearing briefs and a canvas suit, you are able to squat with a wider stance. And the reason being is when you squat with a wider stance, you can push your hips back more, open up the knees really hard, and push into the suit. So once you get down to the bottom, that suit's going to, it's kind of like we're acting like a slingshot. And once you get down to parallel, it's kind of, it takes, that it gives you that strength in the hole, okay? Does that make sense to you? And with a raw squat, that's not the case. So when you do squat with a raw stance, you don't have that massive rebound out of the hole when you're not wearing gear. So I actually wrote an article about this called, it's called Casual Friday, where I kind of dissect it all. But in his, you know, what's his perfect stance? I don't know what his perfect stance is, but I can tell you it's definitely not as wide as what he sees in videos. So he needs to bring that in, definitely. The other thing I would tell him to do, because he does that, is he still needs to have strong hamstrings, strong glutes, strong lower back, but he definitely needs to have strong quads. There's no doubt about that. It gets you know, the whole posterior chain movement that I'm sure you're familiar with, Kevin, kind of hit the last 5 or 6 years or whatever it is. It's almost overdone. Meaning that I'm not saying it's not important, but it's like because people put so much emphasis on that, that they forget to emphasize that, you know, there's still four muscles up front too. And meaning your quads, and those as a raw lifter and even a rip, you know, as a raw powerlifter or a raw lifter in general are going to be extremely important. All you have to do is when you watch powerlifting videos, look, guys that do squat with a wide stance and do squat with gear, their quads aren't that big because they don't really need them. But when you bring that stuff, and then we'll just use bodybuilders as an example. You know, everyone wants to shit on bodybuilders, but I've seen those guys handle some insane weight. You know, their quads are huge. And yes, they do, you know, do a lot of, you know, hypertrophy work, but most of those guys have spent years squatting, and they do squat with a, you know, shoulder width stance or sometimes a little bit narrower. And I do have big, strong quads. So my advice to him would be bring his stance in. Of course, he said, you know, he already did that, and his weights went down. But he's also conditioned his body, you know, probably through prior years for strengthening the muscles that only train the posterior chain and not strengthen his quads. So something as simple as doing some more volume on the work on the squat, even leg pressing, God forbid, right? Lunges, even hack squats, if it's, you know, severely underdeveloped would come into play there. So my advice to him would obviously bring his stance in like he has. Be patient a little bit because he needs to strengthen those muscles correctly again. He's got to get stronger quads. As far as his lifting shoes, Olympic chucks, and wrestling, I've used Olympic shoes and I've used Chuck Taylor's. I've used the metal squat shoes, which are basically like a Chuck Taylor, but a little stronger on the bottom, a little not as cushiony. That is, again, it's going to be kind of open for interpretation. I found I can squat just as well with either of those. Walking out a weight out of a squat rack with Olympic shoes is a lot more difficult than walking out with flat shoes. That's just been my experience. But in general, with a narrow stance squat, the Olympic shoes will probably help you out a little bit. The unfortunate thing is, you know, Olympic lifting shoes cost $100 or more. Chuck Taylor's cost you, you know, $25, and you get them at Target. So, you know, it might be a financial decision too. Let's see here. It all depends. The thing that really kind of glared at me is, you know, he's 6 feet tall. He's 195 pounds. That's pretty small for a powerlifter as far as 6 feet. I'm not telling him he needs to be 300 pounds at all. But what I noticed is when I lost all that weight, the first things that go in the shitter was my squat and my bench press. And it was a struggle getting that back up with the weight loss. So even, you know, 10 or 15 pounds added to his frame would make a huge difference in the squat. Again, a lot of people are so scared to gain weight these days, it's unbelievable. But the thing that I tell people, too, is no one enters the world of weightlifting to get small. To me, that's ridiculous. I mean, who the hell wants to be small, right? And it makes me laugh that people are so, you know, concerned about how they look. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, dude, first of all, you're not a female, you know. And second of all, why do you even care? You know, it's not like you're going to look like a fat piece of shit either if you gain 10 pounds. I mean, mm-hmm. chances are you gain a lot of muscle. And, you know, the funny thing is, this is totally off topic. Girls don't give a shit what you look like, man. If you're like 400 pounds, they might care. But, you know, if I'm not going to date some girl that wants me to have a six-pack of abs, it's pretty shallow, okay? So just live your life and do what you got to do. And trust me, if you're busy living life and being interesting and getting your shit done, a lot more females are going to be attracted to you than if you have a six-pack and are just, you know, narcissistic asshole.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. My take on relationships, too. But bring your stance in, strengthen your quads, try Olympic lifting shoes if you can afford it, and, you know, get your body weight up to 215. There you go. That's my advice to him.
And we're very lucky. We have Jesse, he's watching the live show, and he says, giving us some more information, he said that he started at 130 pounds 3 years ago.
There you go.
Wow.
So this is Jesse that wrote the question?
Indeed.
Okay, and I assume that, I don't know if you can ask here, but, you know, I guarantee his weights went up as his body weight went up, right?
We got about a 10-second lag, so we'll see if he gets the answer that comes in, but it should pop in a second.
So, again, I mean, that extra body weight is going to help a ton, especially, you know, even if the old, you know, drink a gallon of milk a day thing, you know, people, it's not very fancy, but it works because it forces you to drink some more calories, and it's easy to get down. So, I just had like a 6,000 ribs, dude. Cool. I stuffed my face before I got on the air here. But that would, you know, help him tremendously, so. But, that's a hell of a job, too. 3 years to gain 60 pounds, man. That's nothing to laugh at. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, he says that he's consistently going up in weight, and thanks for the answer. So, yeah, awesome to have that interaction with you, Jesse. Let's go to the next question we got from Chris. This is the chin-up question that we were referring to earlier. I'm wondering what Jim's thoughts are on programming chin-ups into a routine when someone has a glaring strength deficit in the lift. Glaring as in 1 to 2 reps before. Strength is shot and form breaks down. The routine I plan on starting calls for 4 weeks of higher reps, 8 to 10, followed by 4 weeks of sets of 5, chins being the first lift of the day, done once per week. Right now, I couldn't do 5s, much less 8s or 10s, so I'm curious how Jim would have someone lay out sets and reps, what movements he may have the person do instead of regular bodyweight chins until a better foundation of strength has been laid. Thanks. So I guess, you know, the real question that we're going to hit on is, you know, what would you have people do? Would you have people go to like a lat pull down, or do you just, like you said before, have them start with just, you know, 2 reps at a time?
Okay. For Chris, I mean, I would probably do chin-ups. I mean, the routine that he has, obviously he can't do. I mean, I guess he could probably, you know, add one of those, the band-assisted chin-ups and go from there, maybe work with that. The thing that I would have Chris do, and this is just in general, is, you know, have him do the multiple sets of one until he tires out on one day. And so let's say he shoots for, you know, 20 sets of one or 10 sets, whatever he can do, and try and maybe add a rep here and there as the weeks go by. The other day of the week, he can either do the band-assisted chin-ups for higher reps, or what we call the body weight row, or the fat man row, which is basically if you take a barbell and put it into a power rack at about chest height or so, and then put your feet out in front of you, grab the bar, and then kind of pull yourself up or chin yourself up. You probably have to see a picture of this, but you're basically doing a chin-up with your feet elevated.
Mm-hmm.
High, actually not lifting your entire body weight. So I would probably recommend that he do at least 2 workouts. In fact, you know, the old adage that I learned from Dave was a lot of this body weight stuff, you can probably do a lot more than people think. And the thing that we always point out is when you join the military, for example, you don't just do chin-ups once a week or push-ups once a week. You do them every single day. And that doesn't mean you have to do hundreds and hundreds upon, you know, every morning you wake up at 5, go run 5 miles, and then, you know, hit the calisthenics circuit. But, you know, if Chris could, you know, do several sets of, you know, one rep every day, you might be surprised at what, you know, what happened. And that's something I would definitely recommend if he does have access to that. Again, it doesn't have to be a killer workout either. I mean, he has to look at 6 months down the line. So, you know, every week I'm going to try and do, this is kind of a favorite thing of mine. It's like, you know, set a goal for every week. So every week, you know, he's got to do 50 pull-ups throughout the week and, you know, get them done any way he can. And he'd probably be surprised at how much better he gets. So that'd be another big recommendation I would have for him. So again, the band assisted, the fat man rose on another day, and then setting a goal every week for X amount. And again, he can start real light fads, want to do 20, and then add maybe 5 or 10 to that total every week until he gets, you know, to like, you know, 50 or 100 or something. And then he might be surprised at what he can do for one single rep. We've got a guy on our website at Elite FTS named Harry Sugga, who's like a chub king. And he could, Chris could easily ask a question to Harry, too, who's helped a ton of people achieve their chin-up and pull-up goals. So the other thing I would tell him too, and tell anyone when they do chin-ups, is do them with multiple different grips. For example, I do a wide grip, a medium grip that are overhand pronated, neutral grip, close and wide, underhand, and I do a lot of rope chin-ups or towel chin-ups where you hang on to something, which helps a ton too. It helps with your grip, everything else. So it's one of the most efficient exercises you can do for your upper body. Upper back, biceps, forearms, especially when you use the ropes, obviously, in your lats. So, highly, highly recommend it. In fact, that probably makes up 90% of my lat training besides deadlifts. So,
very cool. The next question that we have comes from, I think I'm pronouncing this right, Zav from Toronto, Canada. Hey, Jim, first off, I just want to say that I bought your 5-3-1 book right after Christmas and loved it. This may be a dumb question, but can 5-3-1 be applied to a fat loss program as well? I am 205.61, and I'm trying to drop about 10 pounds. If it can be modified, what would you change? Thanks. I can't wait to hear your answer.
Okay, any program, whether this be this program, a concurrent training program, whatever you do, can be applied to fat loss. You just have to make a few modifications to your diet, which is going to be the number one thing. Probably do some cardio work. But the important thing that when people do a strength training program and then they have a goal such as weight loss, that has to be their goal. And my famous thing is I always tell people you can't serve two masters. And you hear all the time, like, I want to bench 5,000 pounds but lose 30, you know, lose 30 pounds, get 6% body fat, run a mile in, you know, 4 minutes, and they have all these goals. Well, you know, they're going to suck at every one of them. They're not going to reach any one of them. So with this in mind, what I would have Xavier or Zav, whatever his name is, do is start the program out as needed be. Okay, get his diet in order, whatever diet he's, you know, following, and understand that if his goal is to lose 10 pounds, that has to be his goal. That has to be his focus. Continue with the strength training, but don't expect him, and he should not expect massive gains in strength, because his goal should be to lose the weight. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as diet, I'm not exactly sure what he has in store. There's a million things out there, but this program can be. In fact, I know some people that have worked with Shelby Starnes, diet guy on our website, that have used this program for the weight loss. In fact, that girl that just came into EFS, the beginner, she's already dropped, like, I think with Shelby, I don't know, 10 pounds or so.
Awesome. Very cool.
But yeah, the big thing is he's got to get his diet in order, and it's not so much the weight training that's going to be the factor, it's going to be the diet, and it's going to be the conditioning, and it's going to be the realization that he's going to have to, that's going to be his priority.
The next question that we have, this is an awesome question from Alan B., who asks, Hey, Gavin, love the show. Thanks for getting Jim on. It's about damn time. I have a question for Jim. I know you have a family, as do I. I have a 4-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter. With a family and kids demanding a lot of my time, I find it hard to get my ass in gear when it comes to nutrition. Do you have any tips or suggestions for sticking with a nutrition program that would facilitate getting stronger while staying relatively lean? Thanks for your help.
Not sure how a family comes into play with this. I think it usually comes into play with training time rather than diet. But, you know, if you have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, you probably have a lot of crap laying around the house, too.
Yeah.
One of the little tricks that I've done, and I did this when I was playing football, I got a little too heavy and I needed to cut about 25 pounds, was, like, I'm not a diet kind of guy. I don't count my calories. I don't do any of that crap. I just kind of eat whatever and let the chips fall where they may, which probably no one wants to hear. But what I did for then was, you know, I still love my Taco Bell. I love eating crap like that. And what I did was, and this is, I just kind of came up with this on my own, was I just, before every single meal, I would just slam a protein drink. And so I would say, well, I'm going to go to McDonald's, but, you know, I'm going to have a protein drink. So obviously, prior to the protein drink, I'm thinking about like 300 Big Macs and, you know, 6,000 McFlurries. And I'm, you know, drink a Metrics or whatever, I don't know, whatever the hell I had laying around the house. And by the time I got to McDonald's, it's like, well, I'll just have one number one, you know, instead of like three. So I was able to enjoy some of the foods that I do like, but I obviously, my calorie content went way down because I kind of, it's kind of like the pre-exhaustion theory, you know, when you do leg extension before you squat, obviously your squat's not going to be as strong.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing that I did with the food, was I always ate just a little, you know, slammed the protein drink and I always ate a little bit less. The problem is when you start having, in, you know, a demanding job, a family and stuff like that, is you can't get too complex with what you got going on. Because you don't simply have the time to cook all the food, unless it's a massive priority, like you're a professional bodybuilder, an athlete, or something like that. So you have to find ways, real simple ways around it, and that's probably the easiest way that I know. And the other thing that I've done, and, you know, people always ask me how I lost the weight, and you're going to laugh at this, is I just stopped eating as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds absolutely retarded, you know, like, it can't be that easy, but I can tell you, for a fact, that probably in 3 years I haven't finished a single meal at a restaurant. I've always taken something home. And the trick to that is, you know, eat about half your food and then just stop and just, if I feel content, then I'm done. Then I won't eat anymore. I'll never stuff myself again. And I see so many people, you know, whatever's on their plate, they'll eat. You know, it's the old adage that grandma passed on from the age of depression, where food was scarce.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was not scarce. Well, for some people it was, but you understand what I'm saying. But I simply stopped eating as much. So I still eat the same crap as I did then. I just don't eat a lot of it. So that'd be another thing too, but the protein thing is probably the easiest way to do it and probably the simplest way. And it's very convenient. I mean, I'm not a shaker bottle kind of guy, but I mean, bring one of those with you anywhere you go and just fill it up with water. So that'd be my advice to him. And, you know, try not to get into the kid's candy, man. It'll kill you. Trust me. You know. So
we got
my son had a pinata at his like birthday party. I probably ate about 6,000 pounds of It's really amazing, though. I mean, I keep on harping on this. Is, you know, I'm not smart enough to figure out all the diet stuff. I barely have the training shit taken care of. You know, I see all these people with all these, you know, they're experts on everything. I'm just really an expert on what I know. So I don't claim to know a lot about nutrition, but to me, it's really kind of a simple thing. It's just a matter of the discipline of doing it, and that's the hardest thing to do. Especially with the family and you're eating out and stuff like that. That's where the protein drinks really can come in. So, there you go.
We got We'll do one more question from Pierce, and then I got one more question about some stuff that you got coming up. But he asks, when Dave Tate was on a few months back, you said you were the go-to guy when it comes to putting together a home weight room. I find it harder and harder to get to a real weight room due to travel time and dealing with the bullshit rules they have. So here's my question. In about 6 months, I will have about $3,000 or $4,000 to spend towards equipment. What would you recommend I get? Right now, all I have are some kettlebells, an Iron Gym pull-up bar, a TRX, and an iPod speaker dock that sounds like a radio from 1940. I know I need a barbell, some weights, a bench, maybe a rack, but I don't know any specifics. Thanks for your help.
Okay, for Pierce, this would be my recommendation is, one, I tell this to everyone I talk to that either opens a huge facility or the home gym, is write down the weight workout or the training workout that you want to do, okay? Because that's going to dictate what you're going to buy. For me personally, you know, you don't really need to do a lot of fancy stuff in the weight room. You do squats, benches, deadlifts, cleans, pull-ups, dips, and stuff like that. With that in mind, if you get a simple power rack with a good barbell, don't cheap yourself on the barbell. Get like a Texas Power Bar or something very much similar to that. Go get weights. You can get weights cheap, usually through eBay, or not eBay, but Craigslist. You can go look for hookers and then go look for weights on Craigslist. And,
it's a great website.
Yeah, fantastic. Or, you know, your local paper, stuff like that. Gyms are closing all the time. They're selling plates for cheap. It'll, you know, save you a ton of money on shipping. But what I would recommend people do is get a good quality rack, even like a 2x2 rack that we sell. We'll run you, I think, about $900 or so. And, you know, put that in your garage, get a weight, get a nice barbell, get the weights, get a flat bench that is relatively inexpensive that you can slide in and out of the rack, get a chin-up bar on there, get some dip attachment, and then I did this, and I'm probably the least mechanically inclined person in the world. I actually built a platform in my garage, and it's sturdy as shit. I put a carpet on top of it so your feet don't slip, and it cost me about $250 with everything. Mm-hmm. And I included all the wood, all the nails, all the glue, all the carpet, everything. So right now, you know, you're looking at a rack that you can squat, bench, and you can do chin-ups and pull-ups in, a good quality bar, weights, and a platform that you built, and you're pretty much set. And then I'd have him, you know, if he's got any extra money that he wants to spend, you know, look at that workout that he wants to do and just fill in the gaps. But in all honesty, all you really need is a rack, a good rack, a good bench to press off of, and, you know, some weights and a platform to pull on, and you're set. I mean, if you can't get a good workout on there, you haven't haven't really schooled yourself in lifting, because it doesn't really need to be that fancy. But the advice I give people too is just don't cheap on the equipment, because you're gonna buy it, and a year later you're gonna wish you would have saved your money an extra 4 or 5 months and gotten something good.
There you go. The last thing I want to ask you about, there has been some talk about some new books. Anything? Mm-hmm. Anything, any information or any kind of updates on those, or when people can expect to see any new books or new material from you?
The Angry Coach and I, that's a pseudonym, The Angry Coach, and I just are finishing up right now. It's called 5-3-1 for Football, and what it is, it's the complete off-season and some in-season training with weights, with conditioning, with warm-ups, with agility work, speed work, med ball work, and position drills, especially for like linemen and stuff like that. So, I mean, basically, all you got to do is get the book, and you're good to go. Mm-hmm. And then obviously have an understanding of the 5-3-1 and stuff like that. So that's coming out, I would say, in the next couple of weeks. I just talked to Bob today, and we bounced some more ideas off each other. You know, Bob's in New York, I'm in Ohio, so obviously we're not hanging out all the time. But we're always on the phone talking about different stuff, and that's almost done. The 5-3-1 for powerlifting. In fact, on this piece, I just printed off all these questions here. I have the basic outline all done. actually on the page on this, and there's probably 20 chapters that I have outlined on here, all the way from training with your gear with this program, peaking for a raw meet, anything you want to do with it involves all the questions I've gotten on using this program for powerlifting. I also have a book coming out that's almost done too. It's a programming book, and it's kind of different emphases on strength, on size, on conditioning, on all these different kind of goals that people would have, and how to put them all together into a cohesive training program over the, you know, a year or 2 years. Or, you know, if you're dedicated to just getting bigger, this is a, kind of the way your program should look, and here's your eating for that, you know, that sample program and stuff like that. The problem is, you know, people are jumping from program to program with no emphasis on a goal or an idea of what they really need to do. It's kind of like I call it, you know, making a stew. Mm-hmm. And just throw a pound of everything in there, pound of beef broth, you know, pound of chicken, pound of beef, and just it turns, you know, ends up tasting like shit, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's got to be right proportions when you start doing, when you start programming stuff. And what I do is, you know, we do have this basic kind of template within the 5-3-1 throughout this entire book. And what I want to do is, all I do is tweak certain parts of it. So the training can be very cohesive when you jump from one set of goals, like, for example, strength to size to conditioning, without altering your entire training program. Just a lot, it's a lot easier to meet your goals and stuff like that. So there you go. I think there's about five training phases in there. So it goes, you know, so if your goal is, you know, we had, for example, I got a kid right now that trains in our gym that's an MMA fighter. And in fact, I got to post this, I'll do this tomorrow. In 170 days, his progress has been ridiculous. And his squat went up almost 100 pounds just in 170 days. Damn. He only trains twice a week there. And he fights, I think, 3 or 4 times a week now. So it's been ridiculous, his progress over these last, 6 months or so. So... And he's maintained the same body weight, 160 pounds. So the kid does work his ass off. I mean, if you tell him to run through a wall, you know, he'll run through 2 of them. So I mean, mentally, he's definitely got it more than a lot of other people do. He's completely committed. So that obviously makes a big difference. So
very cool.
There you go.
And everyone can check that stuff out at EliteFTS.com. That's probably going to be the best place to look for updates on those.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, Jim, thank you again so much for taking an hour and talking with us. And, you know, as always, really would love to get you on again in the future and really look forward to your stuff down the road.
I appreciate it, Kevin, more than you'll ever know, man. It's awesome to know that people actually wanted me, and I appreciate the phone call. So glad I could help people out.
Well, thanks so much, Jim. And it's, you know, it's great to hear that. And it's I think that's definitely one of the great things that we've seen from you as a strength coach is that you really, you know, care, you put your heart into this stuff, and that's what makes it so great. And it's like you said, this is a great profession that we have, and I just thank you so much for, you know, helping share some of that information with us.
Glad I'm here, man. I'm alive. I'm a happy man.
All right, Jim, I will let you go. I'll shoot you an email, and thanks, and let me know if I can ever help you out in the future.
I appreciate it. Thanks for everyone for listening, too, man. Thank you.
Now it's time for the mailbag. The first question that we have comes from Fred. He says, yo, great podcast. Been listening since number 85. I have a question and 2 opinions. We'll start with the opinions, I guess. How are you counting your calories for the Destination Abs diet? I found that with Fit Day, because my computer was not near my kitchen, I was being strict enough in my counting that the fact that I could not okay, I'm going to paraphrase this. He wants to know how I'm tracking calories. And then 2... he wants to know if it's okay that Lee Peel is writing up the diet, and that it's okay that I'm accountable to her, and that I felt I had no problem admitting to her that I ate more than I should have one day. So, number one, I do use Fit Day, and I just put all my food in at once, whether it's, you know, I kind of plan out my meals for the day, and I put it all in there, and if it doesn't work, then I change some things up, and so on and so forth. And yeah, no, I think it's good to have Leapeel, because Leapeel is not only a friend, but she is also a professional. So, you know, this is her gig, and we'll be talking about it a little bit down the road, but I think we mentioned a little bit that things are changing quite a bit. So she, like, Lee's awesome. She emailed me at 4:20 in the morning last night, and she comes, you know, basically with, like, all right, more or less the fact that I want to do more athletic stuff at Boyle's, like, just, you know, put in some more time in the ladder stuff. So we're going to adjust accordingly. And also look at getting my strength numbers up again. I'm actually going to more or less be doing 5-3-1. And then adding in some extra conditioning and agility stuff and plyos and things like that. So she's really cool, and you know, it's awesome. I think it's a lot easier for me to email Lee and be like, Lee, you know what, this and this happened, or this is how I'm feeling about what we're doing right now. I want to change some things up. So she's very cool. And he also had one question. The definition of a supplement, like whey, nitric oxide, BCAAs, gainers, creatine, anablanda, but I think he means anaconda, is a quantity added for example, to make up for a deficiency. If you are dieting, is there a need for supplementation, given that even with the bare minimum nutrient ratios, as per Lee a few episodes back, that it's possible to get the basic RDA as per FDA dialed in? A small caveat is that I am excluding multivitamins and fish oil, but only for people who just like only fish, for, quote, supplement use. And again, I think we didn't understand what the hell this question was, but I think
saying like if the question is
like, what are the supplements you should have if you're dieting? What are the things you?
No, I don't think that's what it was. He's saying if you're dieting, is there a need for supplementation? That even the bare minimum is possible if you're dialed into a good. If I interpret this correctly, it's just the kind of question of, do you need supplements if you're eating a healthy diet? This one, he just happened to say that he is dieting, but does he still need to have anything? I mean, by definition, I mean, I guess as far as what a supplement is supposed to be, it's, I mean, in a sense, no. But I think that we've had this discussion before, and we've kind of come to the agreement that, you know, if it's not going to harm you to take additional, then it's kind of looked at as almost like dietary insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we can all kind of agree on that. I mean, you don't need Nox, no Explode in your diet.
The new thing that an athlete brought into me the other day was Whey Anabolic Extreme or something like that from GNC, which is, it's whey protein, but it's called Whey Abolic or something like that. It's something stupid like that. But cool. Weibolic Extreme. Someone in the chat room cleared that up. Thank you.
There you go.
The next email we got, you know, I thought you might find this interesting, as there were some comments in episode 161 about The Biggest Loser. Former winner Eric Chopin has another reality TV show about how he's trying to lose weight after regaining almost 200 pounds. So he's, lucky dude, got a new show on Discovery Channel, probably signed a nice contract, got some money, and he's going to try to lose the 200 pounds he gained back after going on The Biggest Loser. I guess that's what happens when Jillian Michaels is stepping on your balls all day.
Wow. There you go.
There you go. John, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Let's see. I've heard via Mike Robertson on his site that the levulator scapula stretch can be helpful in some cases but harmful in others. How can you tell for yourself or someone else when to use it? Also, Eric Cressy lists the cradle walk, leg cradle drill, and maximum strength, while Nick Tumanello advocates against it in his article How Not to Warm Up, and offers a variation of the movement. He states it can be it can lead to promoting hip dysfunction. Thoughts on whether it's useful or just bad altogether? Thanks, Neil.
I don't even remember what we said last week about that.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, the levator scap stretch, the idea is that this, again, comes this is not necessarily proven in study, although it's probably a pretty difficult thing to study. So we get this more from this is kind of like a Shirley Sarman approach. This is also that's right. We were talking about the book Anatomy Trains, and the author, I think it was actually an article that he had written. But it's this discussion again of this idea of when is a muscle short, when is it tense or short or stiff, and when is it actually long and lengthened. So when we're looking at posture, we can have a short muscle that needs to be stretched. We can have a muscle that's stiff, that has more activity, and therefore it's not really that the muscle is too short to do its job. It's just that it's increased in stiffness either because of neuromuscular activity or because of increased cross-sectional hypertrophy. So you've got things in a muscle that makes it contract, and you've got things in a muscle that don't work in contraction, and those things that don't work in contraction can actually increase the resistance to stretch, to elasticity. That's an adaptive aspect of the muscle. So the more muscle bulk you have, the harder it is to move that muscle in a sense, and that helps in terms of kinetic energies and potential energies and that the muscle uses to create force. So getting to the levator scap, which is a muscle in the back of the neck that basically elevates your shoulder, does a few other things, but that's basically what it does. If I'm sitting in this forward head posture, rounded shoulders type of posture that many people might get when they work at a desk, the muscle is not actually the muscle is not short. It should be lengthened in a position like that, and over time it might remain lengthened. When you see muscles that become too long in order to do their job, they will stiffen up. You may have increased neuromuscular activity because the muscle, in a sense, is fighting to do what it's supposed to do, and you'll have pain. If you stretch a muscle that has pain, you may alleviate some of that pain because you'll turn that muscle off. But in a sense, the idea is that you're actually making it worse over time because now you're making it even weaker. So that's the idea of saying that it might be helpful in some cases. If you have a shortened muscle, it's definitely helpful. But it could be, in theory, harmful. I can't prove to you that that would actually happen. So typically what we'll do clinically is if you have a muscle that's in spasm, we'll do some sort of soft tissue approach on it and possibly some stretching just to keep that muscle quiet. But in my opinion, if you don't address the other factors that got that muscle to spasm in the first place, then you're probably only doing half of what you need to do. Ultimately, it becomes setting yourself back into good position so that muscle can do its job and not kind of freak out. As far as how you can tell, it's general postural approach, but that's not really an objective quantity. You can't prove that this is a bad idea to stretch it in this case or a good idea to stretch it in that case. But you know, when you're just working on your own, that's probably your best lead. That's the only thing that I could think of. Otherwise, you go and you see someone else that can objectively quantify what's going on in your body and what should be stretched versus not stretched. As far as the Nick Tumminello, it was the same thing. I couldn't even remember. I remember reading that article. I also remember that Eric had a response to it on his blog or a response to something like that. I don't personally see what the problem is in terms of a cradle walk in the sense of promoting hip dysfunction.
I think the problem is that people do it incorrectly.
Correctly, yeah. I mean, yeah. That's just like, well, then don't squat because then you'll get hurt.
Exactly.
You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Do
so,
it right.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the hip cradle, especially when you're looking at 5 or 10 reps. Mm-hmm. That's not enough to influence anything in terms of actual structural change. It'll influence neuromuscular, but it's not going to do anything in terms of stretching this or not stretching that. The only thing that even could possibly occur is in extreme positions of flexion, which a hip cradle isn't really, because you've got external rotation of the hip as well. But in those positions, you could actually lead yourself into an anterior acetabular impingement or femoral impingement. But I mean, you know, it's like you could walk into the street and get hit by a car. I mean, I don't know if you're really, really you know, if that's such a bad idea or not. If you don't like it, don't do it. But I would suggest reading those two, both articles, you know, the actual article that Nick wrote and then the and Eric's response as well, and decide for yourself.
I'll make sure to link to those in the show notes, guys. So if you want to go to thefitcast.com, just I'll link to them in the show notes and you can check them out. But yeah, no, and for those out there who don't check out Nick's stuff a lot, you really should. Nick's blog posts and his videos is always something new, although he's got to work on the audio of those videos that he does. I can barely hear what he's saying. But how about, John, how about a new question that we just got in the mailbag at 6:30 a.m. this morning?
That would be fantastic.
It's fresh. It smells – oh, dude, it's still hot. It's from Keith Logan. He says, subject is regularity of workouts for youth. He says, hi, I've been listening to the podcast for some time, and I'm wondering about the effects of training on, say, 18 to 19-year-olds in terms of weight training. I ask this because I have heard that within the first 2 years of training, it is best to do 3 or so full-body workouts per week, yet for intermediate trainees, it is recommended to do split training. How long would each workout be if you have 6 split sessions per week, and what muscle groups should be targeted? Thanks. I'm an 18-year-old Aussie who has been training 2.5 years, 63 kilograms, which, I don't know, what is that, 400 pounds?
63 kilograms is like 135.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. 5'8", you guys have really helped with – why didn't you give us his height in centimeters if he's going to go kilograms? You guys have really helped with my training and have helped me towards my goals, and now I've been starting a human movement degree with bachelor's of nutrition and dietetics thanks to you guys. Cheers, Keith Logan. And also, first – I'm going to preface this. Keith, that's awesome. Like, that's why we do this. And that's why, you know, we don't mind spending our one day off to do these podcasts. But, and we also got another email that I don't know if it's okay that we read. John, did you get that? I forwarded to you and Lee about someone for the accountability thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a really cool email. Yeah.
But I don't want to bring it up because I don't know if it's okay to talk about it. So
yeah, that's fine.
You know, just obviously that's what makes these makes these tires turn, and you guys are awesome fans, and that's why we do it. But let's get to the answer of the question. I'm going to hit on this one for the
go for it.
Start, but. Couple things I want to pick out real quick is that 18 to 19 year olds for weight training, they should be good to go. You know, as long as they don't have any pre-existing injuries, they don't have any movement issues. Obviously, make sure screening them. And I don't know if you're talking about yourself, Keith, but if you want, you can pick something up like Assess and Correct if you need to assess yourself, or you can get a buddy to do it. In terms of training, six lifting sessions per week are too much. I actually like kind of falling into that 3 day of full body training per week to start, just to see how your body kind of reacts to it. If it really is too much volume, your body will tell you. You're gonna feel like crap. You might still get a little bit stronger, but you're going to feel like garbage. You might even get towards a point where you really have to listen to your body. It could be breaking down, and you might be on your way towards injury. So if you're just starting out, 3 full body per week is good. And then if you want to go to like an upper-lower split or an upper-lower and 2 full, go for it. But you have to make sure when you design these programs that, A, you have a lot of things to be accountable for. The soft tissue work, the mobility work, if you are doing it for athletes, the agility work, what sports are they playing? So what's going to, you know, make sense for them? Are you going to be going lateral and linear? How are you going to break that up? Also, any kind of plyometric work, and you got to consider the volume that plyometric work can have on you. I recommend reading, I think Eric actually wrote about this quite a bit in his off-season training manual, but the He and Mike have talked a lot about plyometrics and really the reps and how you should set that up and how much is too much. I think Mike even says like 10 or 12, reps of plyometrics per session tops. And then you also have your conditioning that will come at the end. So if I had my way, I would say like an hour and a half, three times per week, start with full body, you know, do your pull up day, do your, you know, deadlift day and your squat day, however you want to do it. And then go from there. And if you want me to recommend anything, I would actually recommend, checking out like Eric's Maximum Strength book. It has a great beginner's program for strength. Also, Jim Wendler's 5-1, he said he's coming out with a program just for football players. So I don't know if you're talking about football and rugby, but, you know, I find that football and rugby kind of go hand in hand quite a bit because, best part about my job is that just talking to Mike Boyle, you know, just talking to him, you know, working with the combine guys, just kind of standing there, just starting a conversation about med ball work. And then we talked about, talking about plyometric pushing, like horizontal pushing. So, you know, should we do plyometric push-ups, things like that? It's like, I really don't see a use for them. Unless we're dealing with someone like a football player, and I think this would transcend a lot into rugby as well, because, you know, when are you really sticking your arm out and having your hands push back except in, you know, doing a stiff arm in football? Are you really, really colliding together with someone, you know, pushing your, like having your arms straight out in front of you before you grab them and things like that? You know, those are going to be the two biggest things that I'm going to think of when it comes to that. So keep those things in mind. Wow, I just felt like I ranted like Jonathan Fass.
Yeah, that was a pretty good one. Yeah, I don't know. I'll try to do a quick 2 cents in there. This is coming off of evidence. I haven't seen anything.
Oh, Dose is listening. Hey, what's up, Dose? And also check out Dose's book.
Yeah. What up, Dose? Yeah, I mean, the research has shown that there's no difference between 2 to 3 sessions per week. I don't know if there's anything that's come out since the research that I've looked at, but I'd be doubtful. Volume is not as important as intensity and frequency in terms of times per week. So that's where these like split session workouts tends to be a little bit more problematic. For a beginner and for intermediate or advanced, full body workouts can be fine. Intermediate to advanced, you can do a split workout. We like upper lower simply because it allows for a little bit more frequency and it tends to be a little less in terms of isolation exercise. Isolation is fine, but once you've worked out asymmetries in strength or weaknesses in certain muscles, your use of isolation exercise becomes less valuable. It doesn't seem to make a difference when things are strong. When things aren't strong, the research is also clear. Isolation and integrated into compound is your best bet. So you use isolation until everything is kind of working completely, and then you keep that to a minimum. So that's really – it's more of a knock. That's more of the knock on what body part splits are. They're heavy into isolation or they're heavy into volume, and both of those things become less valuable as you progress along. Volume is valuable to a point, especially as you move from beginner to intermediate, but then there is also some, you know what, I don't even know if I can say that that's evidence. I don't think I've seen anything. The only thing that I've seen in terms of volume is that it appears that anything more than I think it was 5 to 6 sets does not seem to produce any appreciable difference in outcomes of strength or performance. But the things that I've read, which haven't been proven to my knowledge, is that as you become more adept at use of your muscle, and so you're firing muscle more appropriately, then you may not actually need that much volume because you're in theory using the entirety of your muscle as intensity increases. So I tend to go very low in volume in most of the workouts that I write or perform because it just doesn't seem like it's evidenced to show that increased volume does anything. And if that's the case, then a use of a body part split doesn't really mean much. that all changes when you're on performance-enhancing drugs, and that's why bodybuilders all use these high-volume body part split isolation exercise type of workouts. But for people that aren't doing things like that, it doesn't seem to be beneficial.
Cool. Also, let's do another new question.
Sure.
I like this question we got from Sal. First, he mentions that he also has a pull-up bar in his doorway, and that he's found that L brackets instead of the door frame work quite well to keep it sturdy. So keep that in mind. But his question is regarding pull-up. Since I have the pull-up bar in my room, I do 10 pull-ups probably 4 to 5 times every day just because it is there and I have 30 seconds to go. The max number of pull-ups I can do at once is something like 15. Usually if I am doing a set of pull-ups, I will do 3 sets to failure, which is something like 15, 12, 8. I was wondering how long these three sets of pull-ups to failure, 3 sets with a minute or so in between, compares to 4 to 5 sets of 10 throughout the day. Is doing pull-ups throughout the day as an effective way to build strength, or would it be better to just focus on the session, be the focus of the session? I was wondering if you could talk about the epoch effects of pull-ups or push-ups throughout the day. Thanks. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Okay, cool. Basically, let's break this down. There's a couple of questions in one. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we'll hit on is, you know, just doing pull-ups throughout the day and just putting on tons of volume through pull-ups with body weight. But the, you know, talking about that for a second, honestly, I'm not a gigantic fan of that. Jim Wendler, who you're going to hear in a little bit, talked about it where, God, it was just 2 days that I talked to him and I can't remember what he said exactly, but he was talking about pull-ups and, you know, how he likes to, he would just do something, then go do pull-ups, then do something, then go do pull-ups, go do something, mm-hmm. go do pull-ups, just to get up to that, you know, get to a number when your number needs to be respectable, like doing 15, which you can already do, so. But doing, let's talk about doing 3 sets to failure with a minute rest in between, or 4 to 5 sets of 10 throughout the day. Which one's better, John?
Oh, I wouldn't go to failure. I mean, you know, it depends what we're talking about. Are we talking about form failure or actual muscular fatigue failure? Yeah. Muscular failure, again, the evidence doesn't support that. It doesn't seem to be required to build strength or size. It is required. It seems to be beneficial to go to a form failure, but to go right before that, not into it. So because actually going into form failure is basically muscular failure. So the idea is to leave the rep where you know that this was the rep that I accomplished properly. The next one isn't going to be good. That seems to be required, but just kind of forcing out reps and using sloppy form, just there's no benefit to it from what we've seen, and there could be some detrimental effects in terms of performance, because now you're basically fatiguing muscles. They can't do their job, so you may be overloading other muscles because of that, and therefore you get pulls and strains and things like that. And if we're talking on a performance level, then certainly that's where people get injured. So I would say that there's no real benefit to doing that. If you're doing it just for the idea of epoch, epoch is minimal. You're doing it all day long, that's fine. That's more like a NEAT argument. So except you are using exercise, but it's the same concept of just being active throughout the day. So I have no problem with that. But I think if you're going to do that, it should be really low volume each set. So if you can do 15, then bust out, you know, 5, 6, 7 pull-ups and not even approach anything that looks like fatigue. If you do that, then you're just, you know, you fatigue your muscle. That's sufficient to cause adaptation. Now you just keep doing it throughout the day. You're not, you're really not getting any additional benefit. If you're interested in increasing the amount of pull-ups that you can do, then you need to be a little bit more traditional in terms of approaching that limit in form, doing, you know, 3 to 4 sets to 5 sets, whatever it is that you want to do, and then backing off for the rest of the day, allowing your body to adapt.
Well, thanks, John. You're over my mind. All right. The one last question before we head out. And, John, it's specifically directed towards you about butt winking. Which I know what he's I know exactly what he's talking about, but
okay,
it's a good question.
Ladies and gentlemen, is why I'm on the show.
Well, you'll understand what he's talking about. He says, "Dear Fickass, the question is for Dr. Fass."
Oh God,
I have noticed that when I do any squat variation, front squat, high bar, low bar, in the bottom position, my butt quote winks. I'm not sure what the technical term for this problem is, but my pelvis tucks under my torso. Mm-hmm. It only happens at the very bottom of the range of motion. After I squat, I feel a small amount of lower back pain. I perform lower body mobility drills for magnificent mobility before I squat. These include squat to stand, walking Spider-Man, fire hydrants, and burn dogs. I also stretch my hip flexors and do wall squats before my workout. Despite all this, my mobility still appears to be subpar. Can you recommend any course of action that will correct this problem? If it continues, I will have to stop squatting completely. Thanks, John. Oh, great. This is an awesome common issue.
Yep. And in general, it really shouldn't have anything to do with the hip flexors. The hip flexors are mm-hmm. shortened in that position, so... to blame the hip flexors for that doesn't make a lot of sense.
And also, what are wall squats? Is that an isometric hold?
No, I think he's talking about more like when you're sliding up and down the wall. I mean, a ski squat or a wall sit would be – yeah, so I think that's mm-hmm. probably what he's talking about. I mean, he could be talking about a wall sit, but I would think it's more of like sliding up and down. Chances are it has more to do with pelvic hip and lumbar mobility, so lumbopelvic mobility, and you at that point you may be dealing with capsular stiffness and maybe lack of lumbar mobility, and that's something that people I think probably get confused about because we hear all the time about don't use your lumbar spine to bend and things like that, but you still need a certain amount of mobility there, so that is probably a little bit more difficult to deal with when you're doing things on your own because that's more of like actual vertebral body motion. So you need your lumbar spine to be, fluid enough and mobile enough to move, to adapt to positions. At the same time, you desperately need hip mobility in terms of capsular mobility and muscular length in order to move properly as well. So it's not just a muscle issue, it's also joint related. So most of the time I put my money there in terms of being able to squat properly without that little dip under. The other aspect of it can be core strength, both transverse abdominis contraction as well as spinal erectors and quadratus lumborum and everything around your core. You need that to be tight in order to offset the urge of the body to kind of dip under. And basically the idea here is you're just moving on the path of least resistance. So if you've got stiffness of the hip, if you've got poor mobility of the lumbar spine and your core isn't strong enough to exert enough force there, then you're just going to move the easiest way, and that's going to be by dipping the hips under to continue to get range of motion. So my advice there is you don't go to that dip. You go right before it. You're getting back pain. It could be a number of reasons. It could be muscular. It could unfortunately also be more joint disc related because that's how you develop, or at least that's how we believe you develop back pain when it's disc related and joint related. It's by unwanted motion under load. That's the easiest way to get yourself hurt. So what you really should be doing is working, continue to work on your mobility. If it's joint related, there are some things that you can do to like self mobilize, but you can also see someone that can do that for you, which is a much easier way to go about gaining joint mobility. And then you just continue to challenge yourself within the range that you have while you increase your range.
Awesome. Yeah, I know. You can definitely see, go into the commercial gym, you see guys squatting down and they just totally lose that arch. And
yeah,
like, oh, that's going to feel so good tomorrow.
Yeah, it really won't.
Or bad.
And Yeah, and it you know, that's a common thing. I do it too. Everyone does it. That also goes back to this argument of stiff versus short muscles. If it's just an issue of stiffness, by loading the individual with weight, you'll overcome that stiffness and you'll be able to squat without that problem. So some people will see that problem with like a body weight squat, but then once they load themselves up, there's no problem in the squat. They don't have that dip. Other people, it doesn't matter if you load them up or not because of shortness or stiffness in the capsule or joint, you'll still dip under, and then it becomes an issue of needing to stretch and get into your flexibility.
Cool. Now, one bonus thing, and John, I can't remember if you mentioned it or not, but to use if you have to, just use a box to stop you for a little bit.
Yep. Yep. Tap to the box. Don't sit down on it.
Yeah.
Just give yourself a little. Use that box to indicate that's where you need to go.
Well, thanks for butting in. I was going to say that, but no, sorry.
Oh well, excuse me, Mr. Kevin Larrabee. CSCS.
CPT. Just kidding. I don't have that.
Yeah, you don't have that, do you?
No. It would be in
You made my head bigger on it. That's great.
Yeah. All right. So then we're going to wrap it up, John.
Wrap it up. I didn't even go back to the Ustream. That's nice. That's a real good look.
All right, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to wrap up the show here. So thanks, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of the FitCast. Please do not forget, check out thefitcast.com. Check us out on iTunes. If you haven't checked out the live stream before, try to check us out in the live stream. That way we can talk to you in the chat, and we can interact with you a little bit more. Also, there's some more videos and blogs that will be showing up on thefitcast.com, so make sure to check back regularly. You can check out John's blog for some reason. It's not going to be anything on there, but yeah. Give it a look. And that's it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next time. Take care. Oh, wait, John, Pink Dumbbell Award?
Pink Dumbbell Award goes to you for not being able to figure out the sound for this week's show in the video. What was this, 164? What episode are we on?
164.
Wow. That's a lot of episodes.
Oh, man, dude, I forgot to hit record. No, because the thing, it says hijack, and if you highlight hijack, I thought it was recording.
You're kidding.
I am kidding. We'll see you next week.
Nice.